Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Crime House.
The last time anyone heard from Betty Gore, she was a 30-year-old wife and mother standing in her own kitchen in Wiley, Texas. By that night, she was dead on her utility room floor, struck with an axe 41 times. And the only person who was in that room walked out, drove to a movie with her kids, and spent the rest of the day telling herself to act normal. Her name was Candy Montgomery. She taught Sunday school, she sang in the church choir, and for almost a year, she had been sleeping with Betty's husband. Today, I'll take you back to the beginning of Candy's story, the marriage she built like a checklist, the affair that no one in town saw coming, and the two completely different versions of what happened in that little room on June 13th, 1980. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are that decades later, they're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. Crime House exists because of listeners like you. Want even more? Join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday ad-free. You also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early, and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime show page. And to help keep growing our community, be sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of extreme violence and mutilation of a body, so please listen with care. This is the second of our three-episode series on Candy Montgomery and the killing of Betty Gore. Today, I'll introduce you to Candy, walk you through the affair that gave this case its motive, and lay out the two competing versions of what happened on the day Betty died.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
Last we left off, the police in Wiley, Texas had just gotten the phone call that turned the whole case on its head. Alan Gore confessed that he'd been having an affair, and that woman he'd been seeing was Candy Montgomery, the same Candy Montgomery who'd been the last person to see his wife alive. To understand how a church-going Sunday school teacher ended up at the center of one of the most infamous killings in Texas history, you have to understand who Candy Montgomery actually was. And that's where I want to start today. Candy was born as Candace Lynn Wheeler on November 15, 1949. By her own account, she grew up in a strict, emotionally rigid household. Her dad had served in the Army, and he'd run the family the way he'd run a unit, structured, orderly, with clear rules. And according to Candy, there wasn't much in the way of emotional support. A kid who grows up in that kind of environment learns to adapt. And the way Candy adapted was to put her feelings in a box and present a calm, capable face to the world. By the time she was an adult, that was simply who she was. Organized, social, and grounded. The people around her described her as strong, and from a very young age, she'd learned that staying composed was how you earned approval. That same instinct for order shaped how Candy approached just about everything, including her own life plan. She was a checklist person. There were things you were supposed to do in roughly the order you were supposed to do them, and Candy intended to get to all of them. And by the time she hit her 20s, one item sat right at the top of the list: get a husband. She found him pretty quickly. His name was Pat Montgomery. But here's where Candy's story already starts to look different from Betty Gore's. Betty had fallen for Alan. There was real feeling there. But Candy didn't fall madly in love with Pat. It was more that Pat fit her plan. He was a man who wanted children and had a stable enough job that Candy wouldn't have to work. On paper, he checked the boxes. So in 1970, the two of them got married and Candy crossed another item off of her list. The kids came soon after, a boy and a girl, both born in early 1970s. Check and check. And in 1977, when Pat landed an electrical engineering job in Dallas, the Montgomerys settled into a house in Wiley. Candy became a homemaker, and just like Betty, she found herself in a brand new town, surrounded by strangers, quietly desperate for a sense of community and a feeling that she mattered. Now, this is the part of the story where a lot of people expect Candy and Betty to become best friends, but the truth is the two women were very different people, and you could feel it. Betty was emotional and a little guarded. Candy was structured, sociable, and the kind of person who could walk into a room of strangers and walk out with three new friends. And as we talked about last time, Betty had quietly developed a reputation around the church for being sensitive, the sort of person other women felt they had to choose their words around. So while Candy and Betty were members of the same congregation and friendly enough, they were never close. And here's the thing about Candy's life in Wiley. From the outside, it looked complete. The husband, the kids, the house, the church. But somewhere in there, Candy started to realize that being a housewife in suburban Texas wasn't all it was cracked up to be. She filled her days with church activities, teaching Sunday school, and singing in the choir. But at home, there was nothing that excited her. The kids spent their days at daycare, Pat went to work, and when he came home in the evenings, their marriage wasn't exactly electric. By Candy's own description, things in the bedroom were nothing to write home about. And for someone wired in the way Candy was, that emptiness was harder to handle than it might sound. Her whole sense of self was built on doing the next right thing, being the woman who had it together, who was good at all of it. But she'd run out of the next thing. The list was finished. The husband, the kids, the house, the standing in the community, she'd checked every box she was raised to check. And the prize on the other side turned out to be a string of quiet, nearly identical afternoons. She wasn't miserable exactly, and that's part of what made it so disorienting. There was nothing obviously wrong with her life. By every external measure, she was winning. She was restless in a way she couldn't explain. And for a person who likes to have a plan for everything, unexplained restlessness is its own kind of crisis. You can't make a checklist out of "I feel empty." So the plain truth was that Candy Montgomery was just bored. And she did what a lot of people do when the life they've built starts to feel like a very comfortable cage. She went looking for a door. But the thing she reached for wasn't a new job or a hobby or a move across the country. The thing she decided would shake up her life was an affair. What's striking is how Candy approached even this. She didn't drift into a romance that swept her off her feet. She approached it as she approached everything, logically, almost like a project. The plan had rules. It would be sex without feelings, there would be clear boundaries, and if anyone started getting attached, the whole thing would end. She was so matter-of-fact about it that she actually talked it over with some of her girlfriends at church, like she was working out the logistics of a home renovation. Now, all she needed was the right person for the job, and it wouldn't take her long to find him. The man Candy settled on was Alan Gore. The way it started was almost mundane. Both Candy and Alan had joined the church volleyball team. They'd see each other at games, chat between matches, the easy small talk of two people who run in the same circle. They were just friends. Candy had never thought of Alan in a romantic or sexual way at all. There was no grand romance, no lightning bolt, just two married people from the same church on the same rec league volleyball team. If you'd watched them between games, you'd seen nothing more than two friends who got along well. But the line between that and something else can be a lot thinner than a lot of people like to think. And Candy and Alan were about to walk right across it. Because in the fall of 1978, something shifted. Candy later said that one day she simply looked at Alan differently. And in that moment, she knew that he was the man she was going to sleep with. The conversation started getting flirtatious. Until Candy told Alan in plain terms that she was attracted to him. And then she asked him if he wanted to have an affair. Alan was torn. He loved Betty and he didn't want to hurt her, but he also couldn't pretend his marriage was in a good place. Betty had been struggling. She was moody, withdrawn, and hard to be around as she fought the depression she was trying to overcome. The two of them were actively trying to have another baby, but even that had started to feel clinical. more like a task than a connection. So after some hesitation, Alan said yes. The two of them set the ground rules right at the start. No feelings, just sex. They would keep up appearances and they would always prioritize their families when they planned when to see each other. Frankly, it was about as unromantic as an affair can be. And remarkably, it worked that way for about 10 months. From the outside, nothing changed at all. Alan stayed married to Betty. Candy stayed politely friendly with her. The two families kept going to the same church, kept showing up at the same potlucks on Sunday services, and no one had the faintest idea. And keeping it that way took real discipline, especially from Candy. Think about what they were actually managing. These were two families woven into the same small congregation, where everyone knew everyone and a town this size runs on who saw whom. Candy and Alan had to sit in the same pews, attend the same church functions, make small talk with each other's spouses, and give absolutely nothing away, week after week, for a better part of a year. For most people, that kind of double life would be exhausting, just from the constant vigilance of it. But remember who Candy was. Keeping her real feelings hidden behind a calm, capable face wasn't a strain for her. It was a thing she'd been doing her entire life. In fact, it got even more tangled than that. Betty did eventually get pregnant again, expecting another baby girl in 1979, Bethany. And when it came time to organize a baby shower for her, Candy was one of the women who helped put it together. Picture that for a second. Candy Montgomery helping throw a party to celebrate the new baby of the woman whose husband she was sleeping with. That's the level of normalcy everyone was performing. But rules are easy to set and hard to keep, because the more time Candy and Alan spent together, the more they started to feel something neither of them had signed up for. They were getting attached. The connection between them grew, and at the same time, both of them were becoming more distant from their own spouses. For weeks at a time, they'd talk about ending it, voicing the exact fear they'd promised to guard against, that they were getting too involved, and then they'd find some reason to keep it going, and the feelings would deepen a little more. By the summer of 1979, other people were starting to notice that something was off. Although some scripted shows depict Pat Montgomery finding out about the affair after discovering a letter from Alan, there's no reported account that Pat knew about the affair. But Betty Gore was a different story. She started to sense that something had gone wrong in her marriage. The timing of all of this is genuinely sad. The Gore's second daughter, Bethany, was born that July. A new baby is supposed to be the thing that pulls a couple closer together. But Betty was scared. Her first pregnancy had been brutal, and she was terrified that her depression was going to come roaring back even worse than before. And now, right when she needed Alan the most, he felt further away than he ever had. After Bethany was born, the two of them were barely intimate, and on the rare occasions they were, Betty later said it was like Alan wasn't even in the room with her. Eventually, Betty couldn't hold it in anymore. She broke down to Alan and told him that she'd come to believe that he didn't love her anymore. Alan insisted that of course he did, but deep down he knew that wasn't really true. The feelings he developed for Candy had become very strong, strong enough that he finally understood he had to end the affair. When he told Candy it was over, she was heartbroken. She admitted to him that despite all of the rules and the precautions, she'd fallen in love with him. And Alan told her that this was precisely why the affair had to end. So that was that. Candy and Alan broke it off and tried to return to their ordinary lives, relieved that neither of their spouses had ever discovered the truth. But even though they'd been preparing for this very moment, breaking it off wasn't easy. They developed genuine feelings for each other. Candy went home heartbroken to a marriage she'd been bored by in the first place. Alan went home to a wife who could feel without being told that his heart was somewhere else. Nothing had actually been solved. The affair was over, but everything that had set it in motion was still very much alive, and Betty could sense that something was still wrong. She couldn't shake the feeling that something had changed in Alan over the past year, and she had a pretty good idea what it was. The late nights after volleyball, the inside jokes, the easy closeness between her husband and the Sunday school teacher down the road. To Betty, it was starting to look obvious. She'd become convinced that Alan was sleeping with Candy Montgomery. And Betty had decided she was going to find out for sure. Which brings us to Friday, June 13th, 1980. Here is what everyone agrees on about that morning. On June 13, 1988, Candy Montgomery had a list of errands and house guests. The Gores' oldest daughter, Elisa, had slept over at the Montgomerys the night before, and the kids had begged to do it again, so Candy said yes. But she knew Elisa had a swim lesson that afternoon, so she figured she'd save Betty the trouble and just take Elisa to the pool herself. All she needed was Elisa's bathing suit, so she planned a quick stop at the Gores' house. A few minutes, in and out. She knocked, Betty answered, and Candy stepped inside. Everyone also agrees on how that ended. By that night, Betty Gore was dead on her utility room floor, having been struck with a 3-foot axe 41 times, and Candy Montgomery killed her. What no one can fully agree on is everything in between, because the only two people in that house were Betty and Candy, and only one of them lived to tell her side of the story. So when this case went to trial, the jury was handed two completely different versions about what happened in that room, and asked to decide which one to believe. Let me give you the version Candy and her defense team told first. In Candy's account, she and Betty sat in the living room at first talking about nothing in particular, their kids, their plans for the week, etc. But when Candy mentioned the swimsuit and said she really had to get going, Betty went quiet and stared at the floor. And then in an unsettlingly calm voice, she asked, "Have you been having an affair with Alan?" Candy was so startled by how blunt it was that she blurted out, "No, of course not." But she answered too fast, and Betty saw right through it. "But you did," Betty said. And Candy, realizing Betty already knew, confessed. She tried to reassure her that it was over, that it had been over for a long time. What happened next is where it turns. Betty stood up, her eyes strange and distant, like she was somewhere else entirely, and told Candy to wait there. She left the room and came back holding an axe. Still not quite looking at Candy, she said in a flat voice that Candy was never to see Alan again. Candy promised. She offered to bring Elisa straight back, to forget the swim lesson and the sleepover entirely, but Betty didn't seem to hear her. She set the axe down and told Candy to go get the swimsuit out of the utility room dryer while she went to grab a towel. Candy said she did just as she was told. She just wanted to get out of that house. She found the swimsuit and was stuffing it into her purse when she felt that she wasn't alone, and she turned around to see Betty standing in the doorway. In that moment, Candy said she could see the pain on her friend's face, and she knew she'd caused it. So she reached out to touch Betty's arm and said, "I'm so sorry." And according to Candy, that touch is what set everything off. Betty knocked her hand away, then shoved her hard. Candy stumbled backwards as Betty ran out and came back with the axe. And this time she raised it over her head with both hands and screamed, "You can't have him, you can't have him, I have to kill you." She swung, Candy dove out of the way, and the blade just missed her. The swing threw Betty off balance, and Candy grabbed for the weapon. The two of them fought over it, scratching and clawing, neither willing to let go. Candy said she bit at Betty's fingers, and then in the struggle, she shoved Betty hard enough that Betty's grip slipped, and Betty went down against the freezer. Now, Candy had the axe. The defense's account of the wounds came down to one chilling detail. Candy said that after the first blow, Betty crumpled, and Candy thought she had killed her, and was actually about to drop the axe and leave when Betty threw her body against the door, trapping them both inside. For several minutes, she said, the two women fought, the blood making everything slick. Every time Candy tried to get out, Betty stopped her. Candy kept pleading, and at one point, Betty put a single bloodied finger to her lips and said, "Shh." Candy claimed that sound is what broke her. That one shushing noise reached down into something buried deep in her psyche, and her mind went black. She no longer wanted to plead or reason or escape. She wanted to destroy Betty. And in a burst of rage that she said felt foreign even to her, she swung the axe again and again and again and did not stop until her body physically couldn't anymore. That's Candy's story, self-defense that tipped in a single triggered instant into something she could not control. Now here's the problem. The prosecution looked at the exact same room and saw a completely different story. In their version, there was no calm question and no trance. They argued that Betty, exhausted, heartbroken, terrified, and sliding back into depression, finally worked up the nerve to confront the woman who she suspected of stealing her husband. And confrontation was hard for Betty. She was emotional, teary, and pleading. In the prosecution's version, Betty begged Candy to stop seeing Alan, and it was Candy who snapped, either because she wanted Alan for herself or because she was terrified that Betty was about to expose her secret to the whole town. And to a woman who'd spent her entire life managing how she appeared to others, the prosecution argued that exposure was unbearable. In their version, it was Betty backing away, apologizing, insisting she only wanted to save her marriage, and it was Candy who advanced on her, who got physical, whose eyes landed on that axe, and when the violence started, it didn't stop. The prosecution's whole case rested on one question they hammered over and over. If this was really self-defense, why didn't Candy stop? How do you bring an axe down on someone 41 times and call it fear? To them, 41 blows wasn't panic. It was overkill. It was rage. It was murder. However the killing happened, the physical evidence tells us what came after. Candy was covered in blood. She rushed into the bathroom, leaving a flip-flop print in the bloody mess on the floor, and climbed into the shower with her clothes still on, trying to wash it all away. As she pulled herself together, she thought about the fact that Alan was out of town and might not be home for days, which meant Betty might not be found right away. She vaguely thought about baby Bethany still upstairs in her crib, and she decided to do nothing about it. The thing she kept telling herself was simple: be normal. So she did. Candy gathered her things, walked out of the Gore's house, got in her car, and drove away. That's likely the moment a 5-year-old named Tina saw her leave. From there, Candy went home and changed her clothes, throwing the bloody blouse and jeans into the wash. Then she did exactly what she'd planned to do that day. She took Elisa to her swim lesson, she took all the kids to see a movie, The Empire Strikes Back, and she let Elisa sleep over for another night. All day long, she repeated it to herself like a mantra: be normal, be normal, be normal. She had no plan beyond that. She was just hoping no one would find Betty too soon. But of course, someone did. Alan's worried phone calls sent the neighbors into the house, and they found Betty that very night. And once Alan confessed to the affair, the investigation snapped into focus. And it didn't take long for the evidence to catch up with Candy. Remember that bloody thumbprint on the freezer door? During one of her interviews, the police had taken Candy's fingerprints, and when they compared them, the thumbprint on that freezer was the exact match to Candy Montgomery. It put her hand and Betty Gore's blood in the room where Betty died. On June 26, 1980, just 13 days after Betty was killed, Candy Montgomery surrendered to face a murder charge. Her trial started 4 months later, and it would become a genuine spectacle. And the defense was about to do something that almost nobody saw coming. They weren't going to argue that Candy didn't do it. They were going to stand up in open court, admit that Candy Montgomery had killed Betty Gore with an axe, and then try and convince 12 jurors to let her walk out a free woman. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts, so make sure to comment below.
The affair started as no feelings, just logistics. Do you buy that anyone can actually keep an arrangement like that contained?
Almost never. And I think this case is basically a clinic in why. What gets me about Candy is how much she treated her own life like a project plan. Get the husband, get the kids, get the house, check, check, check. And then she approached the affair the same way. Here are the rules, here are the boundaries, no one catches feelings, and if they do, we shut it down. She literally talked it through with her friends like she was planning a renovation. But you can't project manage attraction. Feelings don't read the terms and conditions. And sure enough, within a few months, the two of them are spending weeks at a time agonizing over whether to stop and then finding excuses not to. The structure she built to keep herself safe is the exact thing that fell apart first. And honestly, there's something almost tragic in that, because I think the rules were Candy's way of telling herself that she was still in control of her life, but she wasn't. Nobody is, not really. The affair didn't shake up her boring life the way she wanted. It blew up 4 lives and ended a fifth.
Let's talk about the baby shower. Candy helped organize a shower for Betty while she was sleeping with Betty's husband. How do you even sit with that?
It actually makes me feel sick to my stomach, the fact that people are able to do things like this and sleep with someone's husband that you call a friend and host them a baby shower while you're doing that behind their back. And I think it tells us a lot about who someone like Candy is, that she could stand in a room celebrating Betty's pregnancy and keep that wall up perfectly. And it reframes how you hear that be normal later in the day. Because acting normal under impossible pressure definitely wasn't something new to Candy or something she invented on June 13th.
We got Candy's detailed, dramatic version of the killing, the trance, the shushing, all of it. How much weight should we give an account when the only other witness is dead?
I think we're forced to give it weight because it's the only account we have to go on, but giving weight to something doesn't mean we have to believe it. Candy is the only living person who was in that room, which means she got to narrate the most important event of the entire case with no one to contradict her. Every beat that makes it sound like self-defense, Betty grabbing the axe first, Betty locking the door, Betty saying, "I have to kill you," all of that coming from the one person with the strongest possible reason to shape the story. Personally, I think the majority of the forensic evidence and the way she behaved after the fact tell a different story, but there are a few pieces of physical evidence that are hard to square with a cold-blooded murder. The biggest thing is that the murder weapon was Betty's own axe inside Betty's own home. This wasn't something Candy brought with her, which cuts against premeditation, which also leaves room for speculation. Betty was suffering from postpartum depression, and she would go to very far extents when her husband was traveling for work, even apparently calling his work to ask them not to send him on these work trips anymore. Could she have gone into a rage and actually grabbed an axe to confront Candy? Unfortunately, we will never know.
The prosecution's whole case was basically one question. Why 41 times? Is that a fair thing to hang a murder charge on?
I think it's the single strongest card they had, honestly, because self-defense has a logic to it, and that logic has a stopping point. The moment the threat is gone, the danger is over, you run, you call for help, you're done. One blow, even a few blows, in a genuine fight for your life, a jury can picture that. But 41 separate wounds, with the medical evidence showing Betty was alive for almost all of them, at some point the question stops being, was she defending herself, and starts being, what was she still doing? That's the gap the prosecution lived in. Now the defense had the answer. The whole shushing and snapping story existed precisely to explain those later blows as something other than choice. Whether you buy that is going to be the heart of part three. But I'll say this, 41 is a number that definitely demands an explanation.
It seems like in all of the HBO and Hulu shows about this case, and even in this episode, we talk about Candy a lot. And almost everything is told through her perspective. Do you feel like Betty gets lost?
I never want to let a victim disappear in their own story, and I think it's unfair that even now, decades later, we still tell this story almost entirely through Candy's eyes. The affair, the rules, the trance, the trigger, that's all Candy's interior world. Even the conversations around the HBO and Hulu shows were about who played a better Candy than about the case or Betty at all. Betty was a woman who suspected her husband was cheating, who was terrified of sliding back into a depression that had nearly swallowed her once already, who had just had a baby and who finally found the courage to confront the person she thought was destroying her family. Unfortunately, when it comes to the actual murder, Candy's story is the only one we have, and as I mentioned, we have to give that a certain amount of weight. Betty was never able to give her side of the story, but Betty Gore deserves to be remembered because she is not a footnote in Candy's story. It was her life. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. To enhance your listening experience, join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime story dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get all the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early, and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of America's Most Infamous Crime show page. Come back tomorrow for our final episode on Candy Montgomery and the killing of Betty Gore.
The moment a body is found, the clock starts ticking, 48 hours before the trail goes cold. From A&E and Crime House, this is the official podcast from the famous true crime series, The First 48. I'm Carter Roy. Every Thursday, I revisit a landmark homicide investigation in depth with long-form storytelling built for your ears. Listen to and follow The First 48 on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.